More bombs rained down, and Captain Charles Cook of the Pennsylvania began to worry about the dry dock gate. He realized that a direct hit would let in a rush of water, pushing his ship into the destroyers lying ahead. To guard against this, he ordered the dry dock partially flooded and sent Lieutenant Commander James Craig to tighten up the mooring line. Craig carried out the job in nimble, skillful fashion, paying no attention to the bullets that whipped the ground around him. He seemed to live a charmed life. At 9:06, he stepped back on board, just in time to be killed by a 500-pound bomb that shattered the starboard casemate he was passing through. Bosun's mate Robert Jones rushed up to help the men hit by the blast. He gently pulled a blanket over one seaman who was obviously dead. The man thrashed out with both hands, yanked the blanket from his face. "I've got to breathe, ain't I?" The dock was flooding fast when yard worker Harry Danner suddenly realized he had left his lunch tin down in the pit. He started back, but it was too late. It was sailing away into the Castnan Downs, carried along by the inrush of water, just the way Captain Cook figured a loosely moored battleship might do. When Danner finally reached the top of the dock, the Pennsylvania was still smoking from her bomb hit. He decided she could use some help and rushed up the gangplank. After a brief encounter with the duty officer, who couldn't grasp the idea of a civilian manning a gun, he got on board and joined one of the 5-inch anti-aircraft crews. As the Pennsylvania fought on, a record player could be heard in one of the ship's repair shops. It had apparently been on when the attack started, and no one bothered to turn it off. Now, in the midst of this early morning nightmare, it repeated over and over again the pleasant strains of Glenn Miller's Sunrise Serenade. Up ahead, the Castnan Downs seemed to catch everything that missed the Pennsylvania, a bad hit at 9:06, another at 9:15. By the time the dry dock was flooded, both destroyers were heavily on fire. Explosions racked their decks, and a big blast ripped the Castnan at 9:37. She sagged heavily to starboard and rolled slowly over onto the downs. Seaman Eugene McClarty got out from under just in time, and as he streaked onto the dry dock, another bomb crashed behind him, shaking the gangway loose. It fell into the dry dock as McClarty pulled one sailor to his feet, but two other shipmates were too late, and plunged down into the blazing cauldron. On the quarterdeck of the downs, a single sailor hung on, manning a 50-caliber machine gun. Watching from the Pennsylvania, gunner's mate Millard Rucoy wondered how long any man could stand that kind of heat. He soon had his answer. As the flames swept closer, the sailor seemed to have a harder and harder time keeping his head up. Finally, he dropped to his knees, head down, but with one hand still hanging on the trigger of the gun. That's the way Rucoy last saw him, when the flames and smoke closed off the view. The Shaw was having just as much trouble in the floating dry dock to the west. A bad hit around 9:12, fire spreading toward her forward magazine, a fantastic explosion about 9:30. It was the 4th of July kind. A huge ball of fire ballooned into the air. Bits of flaming material arched and snaked across the sky, trailing white streamers of smoke behind. Once again, the whole harbor paused to take in the scene. Seaman Ed Waskiewicz watched from the Ford Island seaplane ramp nearly half a mile across the bay. At this distance, he knew he was at least safe, until he looked up at the sky. One of the Shaw's 5-inch shells was tumbling end over end, arching directly at him. He dived behind a fire truck as the shell hit the concrete ramp several feet away. It didn't explode, merely bounced 100 yards along the ramp and clanged into one of the hangars. Ensign David King also took in the show from his station on the Helena. The gun mounts, mattresses, and bodies flying through the air reminded him strangely of the dummies and clowns fired from a gun in a circus. Only this time, he mused, no one would land in a net. By now, many of the planes were shifting over to the seaplane tender Curtis, lying off Pearl City on the other side of Ford Island. A little earlier, the Curtis had clipped a bomber, which crashed into her starboard seaplane crane, perhaps the war's first kamikaze. In any case, it started bad fires, and these may have attracted the pilots hungry for a new kill. Sealed in the transmitter room, the Curtis's 4 radio men couldn't see any of this, but they could hear the bombs coming closer, and they could feel the ship shudder from near misses. Radioman R.E. Jones was on the battle phones and couldn't move, but the other 3 could and did. James Raines squatted between the transmitters. On his left crouched Dean B. Orwick. Right in front of him, Benny Schlecht. 3 men packed together in a space 30 inches wide. Raines never really noticed any noise. The incredible thing was the hole that suddenly appeared in the deck right in front of him, and no hole above. How could a bomb do this without coming through the overhead? Then he noticed his left shoe was missing. Then that Schlecht was dead and Orwick hurt. The room filled with smoke as Jones ran over to help. Together they got Orwick to the door, undogged it, and laid him outside. Jones went back to try to move Schlecht, and Raines stayed with Orwick. There was little he could do. A shot of morphine, a tourniquet, a few comforting words. Orwick asked quietly, "My foot's gone, isn't it?" Raines said yes, it was, but everything would be all right. Corman were there now, and they carried Orwick away. To his deep sorrow, Raines later learned that Orwick didn't pull through. Also, he was quite surprised to hear that he had broken his own back. On the beleaguered Raleigh, Captain Simons watched the bomber crash into the Curtis around 9:10, saw another plane in the same formation let go two bombs at his own ship. The first missed. The second was a perfect strike. It landed aft between a couple of gun crews, grazed an ammunition-ready box, passed through the carpenter shop, through a bunk on the deck below, through an oil tank, through the bottom of the ship, and exploded in the harbor mud. The Raleigh took a bad list to port, and from then on the battle was to keep from capsizing. The first step was to get rid of all topside weight. The planes went off on a scouting trip. Everything else went over the side. Catapults, torpedo tubes, torpedoes, booms, ladders, boat skids, chests, stanchions, anchors, chains, rafts, boats, everything. All the time, Captain Simons kept a yeoman busy with pencil and paper, carefully plotting where everything fell so it could be recovered later. Then he got some pumps from the Navy Yard, another from the Medusa, stuffed life belts into the holes, borrowed four pontoons, warped a lighter alongside. He also found time to send Carpenter R.C. Tellen with an acetylene torch to help Commander Isquith investigate some mysterious tappings coming from inside the hull of the overturned Utah. While this work was getting underway, the Raleigh never stopped firing. Captain Simons thought his 1.1 guns had a lot to do with the plane that struck the Curtis, another that crashed north of Ford Island, two more that fell near Pearl City, and a fifth that blew to bits in midair. But there always seemed to be more. Simons watched another plane bomb the Dobbin, moored with her destroyers off the northern end of Ford Island. The bomb just missed the big tender, exploding off her starboard side, but a near miss could do a lot of damage. Shrapnel slashed across her afterdecks, gouging the mainmast and smokestack, ripping a whaleboat to splinters, wrecking a refreshment stand, cutting down the crew at number 4 gun. 22-year-old fireman Charles Leahy watched the blood trickle around the corner of the gun mount, and he thought about the Navy planes that drowned out the soundtrack every night there was a movie. They always come around when we're having a show. Where in the hell are they now? Just east of the Dobbin, the hospital ship Solace was getting ready for a busy day. In the main operating room, Corman T.A. Sawyer was breaking out drapes, getting the sterilizers started. Near him, a nurse stood by, occasionally peeking through an uncovered porthole at the battle raging outside. Heavily influenced by the movie comedian Hugh Herbert, she would exclaim, "Woo-woo, there goes another one," when a Japanese plane was hit. Another nurse was tearing long strips of adhesive for holding dressings in place after surgery. A near miss rocked the ship, hopelessly entangling her in the tape. Out on the promenade deck, a chief petty officer, clearly all thumbs, was hard at work rolling bandages. A steady stream of launches began unloading the injured, sometimes escorted by shipmates and friends. Seaman Howard Adams of the Arizona helped carry a buddy to the operating room. He took one look, turned to the rail, and was sick. But he came back, asking if he could help. It was a big decision, for that day he chose his career, medical work. A few hundred yards north of the Solace, the destroyer Blue cast off and moved slowly down the east channel toward the harbor entrance. As she passed Battleship Row, machinist's mate Charles Etter helped toss lines to the men still swimming in the water. Some were hauled aboard, but others couldn't hang on and fell back into the thick oil that spread over the channel. There was no time to stop for a second try. The men on the blazing wrecks cheered the Blue and the other destroyers, too, as one by one they glided by. As fast as they built up enough steam to move, they got underway, no waiting for skippers who were still on shore. The Blue sailed under Ensign Nathan Asher. His complement of officers was three other ensigns. Aylwin was handled by Ensign Stanley Kaplan, a 26-year-old University of Michigan chemistry graduate in civilian life. Outside the harbor, Quartermaster Frank Handler watched and waited on the bridge of the helm. For 40 long minutes, she and the ward had been out there alone. For all anyone knew, the whole Japanese Navy might be just over the horizon. When would help come?